Part 5 of 6 from set number 3001, Alchemy Past and Present, a BC Recordings copyrighted presentation by Stefan Heller entitled Alchemy and Society, Socio-Political Implications of Alchemy.
All right, now we will address ourselves to the application of alchemical principles to human society and the body politic, which is always a dangerous, perilous subject, inasmuch as whatever one says is apt to conflict with someone's preconceived notions and opinions, because somehow the political passions are still some of the most active passions in our culture, regrettably, because no matter what direction they go to, and no matter what they direct themselves to, they usually turn out to be primarily exercises in futility. If the 20th century has taught us anything, I think it taught us that political salvation ain't much of a salvation, to put it in the vernacular. However, whatever the case may be, you certainly are under no obligation and are not requested to agree with my views. And my views are not the important thing. The important thing will be to try to understand, perhaps, how the alchemical principles of transformation, of the alchemical principles of the transformation process, and of the various ingredients of the alchemical process of transformation may be applied to this particular area of life. We have already seen in the course of our discussions here how C.G. Jung, the great psychologist of the 20th century, had discovered the applicability of alchemical principles and of the alchemical process of transformation to human psychology. We have seen how Jung appeared to have discovered that the human psyche, the human mind, both conscious and unconscious, transforms in the course of its psychological development very much in accordance with a pattern that is extremely similar to, if indeed not identical with, the alchemical process of transformation. In many ways, this was one of the great momentous discoveries of the 20th century, I feel. Not just because it shed a new light on both alchemy and psychology, but because it opened up, I think, the door to considerations which might allow us to see the operations of alchemical or alchemical-like principles in other areas of human life and of human endeavor. If the human psyche itself transforms in accordance with the alchemical pattern, then there is nothing inherently unlikely or impossible about that same pattern having a valid application to other areas of human life. And so we will try to take a look this evening to the application of alchemical principles to society, to the political and socio-economic process, and perhaps thereby give certain indications how we might indeed be faced with alchemy or in alchemy with a pattern of much wider applicability than previously assumed. So we need to keep in mind, I think, first of all, that humans are curious creatures, and if that hasn't occurred to us already in the course of our experience, then perhaps we need to do some more conscious living. But one of the curious features, I think, of the human being is that the human being is, at least in my view, a fairly unique form, life form, as they would say on some of the television programs, like Star Trek and so forth, a unique life form here on Earth, which is both collective and individual in its behavior. And perhaps in equal measure, we are social beings, and as the saying has it, no man is an island, and assuredly no woman either. And perhaps we ought to be grateful for that, because I think few of us are cut out to be either islands or to live on a desert island by ourselves. So our social nature is a very important part of our character. And indeed, we derive a great deal of our stimulation, our energy, both physically and psychologically, from our social nature, from our social contacts, from the fact that we are involved in a variety of human collectivities, beginning with a family and extending from there to all sorts of collectivities, some in which we participate and of which we are members, sometimes in a voluntary and probably more often in an involuntary capacity. Certainly we don't have much choice as to what family we are going to be born into, although at times in the course of our lives we dearly wish that we had had such a choice. Neither do we have all that much choice about what community we grow up in, although fortunately in our culture we live in a situation wherein the considerable mobility exists and we are by no means obliged to remain in the same community, in the same town or hamlet or village or city all of our lives, but we do move around a great deal. Unlike in some countries like the happily deceased Soviet Russia, for instance, and some others in which I have lived, we don't require an internal passport to travel. In fact, I think we would be unbelievably annoyed if such a possibility were suggested to us. So we can choose our place of residence often once we are adults. Maybe we can't quite choose our nation quite as easily, although there too is for the most part, if we have not committed a crime or if we have paid our taxes, the United States will happily let us move to some other country if we so desire, and if the people over there are willing to tolerate us. So we are involved in a whole variety of social situations, beginning with the smallest unit, the family, to others, and all kinds of voluntary associations, churches and societies and professional organizations and clubs and what have you. But on the other hand, look, we are also individuals. We are not like the Borg on Star Trek, who are a mere collective. Neither are we, along more realistic lines, like the constituent members of a beehive or an anthill. We are individuals, and we are conscious of our individuality, and we try to express our individuality. And if our individuality does not receive adequate attention and sufficient freedoms to function, we get very unhappy. So we have social needs and individual needs, and we try to find situations in life which will supply these needs. And as such, I think we need to have some conscious awareness of the constant interaction, and not always harmonious interaction, in fact, of our individuality with our collectivity or our life within a collectivity. Sigmund Freud, the founder of modern depth psychology, of psychoanalysis, struggled with that issue already, and he felt that all kinds of, in fact, all varieties, all the existent varieties of existing varieties of human neuroses were really caused by the conflict and confrontation of the individual with society. society of necessity represses the free expression of various instinctual needs of the individual, and that this repression in turn causes culture and causes society. Then that culture and society causes more repression, and the endless circle goes on. Whether dear old Sigmund Freud with his delightful little Viennese cigars was correct in this assumption or not, that's another question. But certainly, let's say, he was aware of this situation. And so we find that there is a constant conflict, a necessary conflict, between the social life, the social needs and the social position of the human being and the individuality of the human being. And somehow we forever try in various ways how to reconcile creatively and usefully this particular pair of opposites. Now then, we need to take a look at certain ways, only two in this case, two ways in which the social life of the human being, along with the individual life of the human being, have been viewed in our culture. The ancient world, particularly, let's say, the Greco-Roman world, which was dominant at least for the last few hundred years and more along the Mediterranean area and throughout what became Western society, had a kind of patchwork arrangement. The Greeks were certainly very aware of the individual needs and the need for individuality and perhaps even individualism of their citizens. They cultivated the city-state. The city-state being, let's say, a community which by way of its size and the relatively small number of people residing in the city-state would be least oppressive in terms of the individual. The Roman state was somewhat similarly constituted. Both of them had tyrannical governments from time to time, dictatorships and tyrants and emperors, some good emperors, some bad ones. But on the whole, you know, they were sort of trying to work this situation out so that the individual would have some reasonable room for his own activities and that the state would not suffer either. Then along came Christianity and brought in eventually some ideas that were of a somewhat different nature. In fact, I think that a great many of our problems right to this day in terms of the way human societies and especially in the Western culture are run and the way the philosophies of government function are connected with some of the relatively early attitudes of Christianity, of the Christian church towards society. The normative figure along these lines was St. Augustine, or Augustine, the way you want to pronounce him, who came up with a philosophy regarding human society and government that I think some of us would consider rather dismal. It was founded in the corrupt state of humanity as the result of the fall. The fall being the theological notion, the manner in which we exited from paradise. Augustine felt that humans are corrupt beings, that they don't know how to handle freedom. That if they have a lot of freedom, they will inevitably abuse it because of their innate corruption as the result of the fall. And therefore Augustine felt that strong governments, preferably of a Christian allegiance, should rule over them and keep these corrupt humans in line. He even went so far as to saying that even a bad government was better than no government or a weak government, because humans just really don't know how to take care of themselves. Now, we might agree with him in some respects, but we certainly wouldn't agree with him in other respects. But this notion that you, as you are not capable of really and truly looking out after yourself and after your family, or perhaps after your friends, and that therefore there must be a bunch of somebodies, because one somebody isn't enough, above you in society, who are going to take care of you and everybody else, became an ingrained pattern in the thought of Western culture. And with various modifications, it was always there. Whether it was, say, medieval society with its hierarchical structure, where I don't need to go into the details, where, you know, the feudal lord looked after his serfs, and then there was a bigger feudal lord over this feudal lord, a count over a baron, and the duke over the count, and the king over the rest of them, and the emperor over the others, or whether it was later on, somehow this notion that we are really neither good enough nor smart enough to take care of things, and that therefore we have to have others above us to do that, always reasserted itself in Western society. Of course, it also exists in other societies. However, there was always an alternative position. And this alternative position did not go along with Augustine. In fact, in certain ways, it preceded St. Augustine. This was the position that comes to us from the Gnostics, from the Neoplatonists, from the Hermeticists, and among them, because it's all sort of mixed up together, from the Alchemists, that really had a very different view. Because this alternative philosophy, which came from these earlier esoteric traditions, declared that the human is not just a creature made out of the dirt, and on top of that, fallen and corrupted for mishandling an apple orchard and carrying on meaningful conversations with a snake, but rather that this human is essentially, which means within his essence, more than human. That there is something within the human being that comes literally from out of this world, that comes from the divine, a divine spark, pneuma, pneuma, as the Greeks called it, the divine breath, and that this transcendental core within the human is not corrupt, is not fallen, is not sinful, but it is good, perfect, wise. Now, of course, you might say, if humans are so good and perfect and wise, then why don't they lead more perfect and good and wise lives? Why do they mess up all the time? Well, the explanation of the alternative school, let us say, was always that the reason for that is that in their outer nature, in their lesser or lower or terrestrial selfhood, which that inner spark has assumed in coming into this world, there is a lot of obtuseness, unconsciousness, stupidity, but not at the center. And what the human is destined eventually to do is to bring that inner center of perfection and goodness out into the outer world and make it manifest. A potential needs to be realized, actualized, made to happen. This was the ancient view. And while the other, which I mentioned to you before, the other which sort of starts more or less, at least philosophically, with St. Augustine, was always there, pretty much running the show for a long, long time, the other was asserting itself in various ways in the background. You might say the power, for the most part, was exercised by people who had the Augustinian view. But underneath it all, there were always some people who adhered to the alternative view. Now, there were some periods in history when the alternative view really began to emerge. One was the time of the Renaissance. But, of course, its emergence was artistic, philosophical, and mystical. This was also the time when alchemy received one of its biggest boosts and was most popular. And there was a time when, there for a while, when the view of the true nature of the human began to change. The view of the human that at least a certain elite, and elites were far more influential in those days than they are now, held about human nature at the time of the Renaissance was very, very different than the view that the culture held during the Middle Ages. And then, of course, again, other historical developments came and sort of pushed that into the background. Then it emerged once again in the 18th century with considerable power. And in both cases, the new view, as it were, was nourished by the Hermetic and Neoplatonic and to some degree Gnostic roots of the Western esoteric tradition. So there was Renaissance Hermeticism. That was the very time when the Hermetic scriptures, which have the closest relationship to alchemy of all, you know, classical esoteric systems, were rediscovered and translated. And then there was an Enlightenment era Hermetic Renaissance, which was just before the French Revolution. In fact, the origins of the French Revolution may be found to a great extent in this philosophy. The philosophers like Voltaire and Rousseau and Diderot and D'Alembert and all the rest of them, and some of the Germans as well, whose teachings really seeded the French Revolution, all had a view of the human that was not at all according to St. Augustine. They felt that the human had an infinite potential, that the human being didn't need to be dominated and regimented from above, but that the human needed an opportunity to develop what is within the human. And that was the reason for the French Revolution. Now, I don't need to tell you that the French Revolution, right in its own time, while it was going on, went profoundly wrong. Here were the people who were instituted the worship of the goddess of reason and enthroned an actress on the high altar of Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris as a representative of the goddess of reason, and then in short order cut off the heads of 10,000s of people, and the head is after all supposed to be the place where the reason resides, you know. You can see the terrible contradictions that went on. But they were so imbued with what they felt was the necessity to do away with the old order, which was the medieval order, which was the order of the divine right of kings to run society, that they eventually really degenerated into a bloodthirsty anarchy, which then again led to another dictatorship of Napoleon, and so forth. However, the idea was there. And now I'll come closer to what passes for home. The same ideas which gave rise to the French Revolution also gave rise to another development, the American Revolution. This was largely nourished by British representatives of philosophers of the Enlightenment, but the French influence was by no means absent. You have to remember that Benjamin Franklin was the greatly revered American ambassador in France just prior to the French Revolution under the Louis XVI and tremendously highly regarded by everyone there. And due to his connections with the Freemasonry and the various secret orders there, you know, he brought a lot of those things over. And that French Enlightenment figures, the Marquis de Lafayette and various other people, were very much involved in the American Revolution. So the foundations of the American Republic, in many ways, were the only result of the Hermetic Enlightenment, or of Enlightenment Hermeticism, that was not sabotaged as it had been in Europe. And so what was behind that? Behind that, again, was the idea that the human, the individual human being, just by virtue of being human, doesn't need anything else really, in essence, has implanted within human nature the potential of an ineffable greatness. And that all that human society really needs to do, should do, perhaps even must do, is to offer a setting within which this potential of the individual human can develop. Very different point of view from the Augustinian point of view. You know where the Augustinian point of view still maintained itself and maintains itself to this day, in with modifications, even though it is no longer religious, in fascism and in Marxism. These are the ones who say, in effect, that the individual human cannot take care of himself. There has to be a great, big, monolithic pyramid of a state doing it. And, of course, we know what wonderful results that has brought. Now, lest you thought I will never get around to alchemy, how does this potential within the individual human come to manifestation? How does it realize itself? How does it become real? According to the Hermetic and related philosophies, it does so by transformation. It does so by an alchemical process. Therefore, the alchemical principle needs to be encouraged within society, both at the individual and at the collective level. So the first principle is the state, the government, whether it is the leadership of a small community, like, I don't know, a mayor or a city council or something of that sort, or a larger unit, or the United States or whatever, is like an alchemist, ought to be like an alchemist. The alchemist knows that he or she doesn't make the alchemy happen. But the alchemist supplies the setting for the alchemical elements to transform. And a view very contrary to authoritarian or even just basically big government. Because big government, whether it calls itself a dictatorship or whether it calls itself this or that or a people's democracy or any other crassy, democracy, aristocracy, and so forth, a big government always operates on the principle of father knows best. Father being the government, you being the children. And this is not an alchemical principle. The alchemical elements will not work unless they are given room to work. The room is freedom. Now, of course, the circumstances need to be guarded. There should be someone there stoking the fire of the alchemical transformation. It's not a totally anarchistic situation, but it is certainly not a big government or an oppressive government. It is my contention, and I'm not the only one. Certainly, there are a couple of books by the late Mr. Manly Hall, which I think are very, they're sort of romantically and easily written, but are very much to the point. One is The Secret Destiny of America, and the other one I forget. The title is not I Forget, incidentally, but there are two books. And of course, other people have addressed themselves to this. America's Assignment with Destiny, maybe something like that. In any event, in these and other studies, it has been pointed out that this kind of alchemical, hermetic philosophy was pretty much the dominant philosophy of the elite of the early American Republic. This is what they wanted to do. They wanted to create a hermetic vessel within which human beings could go about their transformation and realize their inbuilt, you might say, God-given potential with a minimum of interference from anybody, including themselves, who were the government. Now that, you know, that's rather to their credit, because people who have power almost inevitably want more of it. There must be something to power that is very much like an addictive drug. The appetite for it seems to be cumulative. And also, like an addiction, people who once have power hardly ever like to let go of it. However, the founders of the American Republic were not quite thus disposed, neither were some other enlightened governments who came out of that kind of philosophy. Now then, that being the case, we then, however, need to see the alchemical principle also represented, let's say, on a somewhat wider level. In other words, the individuals are to transform alchemically, and what they really need is an opportunity to do so. That's very, very important. That's the fundamental principle, let's say, of an application of alchemical principles to human society. It is not unlike, say, some of the principles of the Tao in ancient Taoism of China. The Tao is always trying to work. The Tao is always trying to happen. If the Tao doesn't happen, it's because something stands in its way. People stand in its way. People's power stands in its way. So this is a kind of recognition using, again, Jung's statement, which I like so much: I don't make myself, I happen to myself. You know, when you talk about historical developments, they can't be oversimplified too much. And that's what I am doing now. There were and there always are a lot of other factors involved, and those I haven't mentioned because I don't have the time for it. And certainly there was a rationalistic strain in the philosophies of the Enlightenment also. That rationalistic strain felt, for instance, that education, schooling, was one of the main ways whereby this alchemy could be nourished. Hence the great emphasis of the founders and the earlier leadership of the American Republic on education. They felt that education extended freely to everyone who is willing to avail himself of it. It would be sort of like the alchemical vessel, that when people used their minds and acquired the tools of learning, this would greatly facilitate their transformation. Well, to some extent that is true, but let's see what happened these couple of centuries and then some after the foundation of the American Republic to our educational system. I don't think that most institutions of our public education at all different levels qualify very much as marvelous alchemical vessels of transformation any longer. Nevertheless, you know, that was a big idea. And then there were various flies in the ointment, and these are the ones we need to consider now. First of all, there was an element, pretty powerful element, pretty numerous element in the populace of the United States right from the beginning, that did not have an Enlightenment hermetic outlook. These were the Puritans, the people who came over, of course, before the foundation of the American Republic, and we are generally given such a romanticized image of these dear people. You know, every Thanksgiving we are sort of given the image of these quaint people with their kind of pointy hats, almost like witches' hats, although they killed the witches. They didn't burn them in this country, they just killed them anyway. And their big buckle shoes, and, you know, them interacting with the Indians there, and then roasting the wild turkeys and all of that. And that, you know, the dear folk came here because of religious persecution and lack of religious freedom in Europe. The truth of the matter is that they took over at a certain period in England, and they made life so terribly miserable to everybody else under their champion Cromwell that the English became thoroughly disgusted with them. They outlawed Christmas. They broke into all the churches and places and destroyed all the stained glass windows and the beautiful religious statuary and so forth. They reduced life in merry old England to a terribly drab and miserable condition. They even outlawed the baking and eating of mince pie. Now, anybody who would do that, I think, should take a boat and go somewhere far away. And that's exactly what the British felt about the Puritans, and consequently the Puritans came here. The Puritans came here because they made life so miserable for everybody else that they had to leave. And then, of course, they proceeded to make life as miserable as they could here. Now, you know, these people were Calvinists, which is about the most awful form of Christianity that I can think of, although perhaps there might be one or two other more awful forms lurking in some corner that I have forgotten about. The Calvinist Puritans have been characterized by a joke, which, however, is a good one, that the Puritan person said that ice cream must have been invented by the devil because it tastes so good. So it's an attitude to life which is very much riddled with a kind of killjoy philosophy, but which at its core has a conviction that is very much like the conviction of Augustine. In fact, John Calvin and Luther both were very fond of Saint Augustine and his teachings, namely that humans are corrupt. They don't deserve a lot of freedom. They should be very greatly regimented. The regimentation should occur on the basis of religious law, theocratic considerations, and so forth. And then they have some other quaint little teachings that became responsible for curious conditions in American society. Among these being their teaching of predestination. Now, predestination also comes in part from St. Augustine, and it's the idea that God being all-knowing, right? God is all-knowing. So if God is all-knowing, then God must know all along whether you are going to go to heaven or to hell. How could it be otherwise? It's logical, but you know, that's the trouble. You shouldn't apply too much logic to religion. Religion is not meant to be logical. Religion is meant to be mystical. Religion is meant to be devotional. Religion is meant to transcend logic as much as other physical things. It's a terrible, terrible mistake. Here is a good example of it. Okay, God knows whether you are going to go to heaven or hell. So there really isn't really all that much that you can do about it. You just kind of do the best you can and you hope you're going to go to the better place rather than to the worst place. But the problem is that there is also this terrible doubt in your mind now, you know, which is really the place that God decided that I should go? What the heck is going to happen to me? So you try to find out. But you know, you can ask God a lot, but he hardly ever tells you. So therefore it's a very dicey situation. Now then, here is the idea that they came up with. If you are destined to go to heaven, if you are one of the righteous, then God likes you. And he is going to bless you in this life as well as in the next, right? That means that if you do well in this world, you make money, you are successful, this is a sign of God's favor. And this indicates that God likes you and that you're also going to go to heaven. So you really have the best of two worlds. You'll have worldly success and then you'll have otherworldly success. And this led to what? To the work ethic. To the Calvinistic striving for material success and material goods, which of course is still very much with us in this particular culture. Now this Puritan influence, which is always with us. Now, there are not a lot of people nowadays who would call themselves Puritans. There are even not a lot of people who call themselves Calvinists. The Presbyterian Church is supposed to be of Calvinistic origin, but it's sure not like the Puritans used to be. In fact, I know a number of very nice Presbyterian ministers who, when the congregation isn't watching, will even have a glass of brandy with me. So forth. Nevertheless, this Calvinistic attitude became very persuasive in the American religious life, and it is still with us. It is the core of fundamentalism. It is very heavily influenced the Baptist movement, especially in its later developments and so forth. And it's very much with us. It's certainly the core of the religious right at the present time. So this was certainly very antithetical, let's say, to the Hermetic philosophy which I was just talking about. Then there is yet another influence, and that's much more difficult to pinpoint. Yet in certain ways it is very important, and perhaps in terms of the alchemy of American society, and I'm using American society now as an example, how these alchemical principles may apply. They apply in other ways in other societies. Now I got to get back to the great reviver of alchemy in our days, C.G. Jung. When Jung traveled in America, beginning, I think, the first time about 1909 or somewhere around there, and at various other times, he diagnosed, you might say, that, first of all, he said that there is a lot of puritanical repression. He called it prudishness in the American psyche. And you must remember this was before the 60s and the sexual revolution and so forth. But there is a lot of prudishness, and that prudishness in turn breeds brutality. So the puritanical repression leads to various brutal excesses in other areas of life. That was one of his statements. But another one is far more important, maybe germane to our purposes. He said that there are at least two cultures, and this was before multiculturalism, and certainly before the titanic influx, let's say, of Latin America into the United States. And so they said there are two cultures that are very, very different from the mainstream American culture. And one of these are the descendants of the African slaves who have been brought here. It may be a subculture, but it's a culture nevertheless. It has an entirely different psychological structure of its own. And then there is another that is even older than that as far as the American continent is concerned, and that is the American Indian, or now called Native American, background. Both of these are significantly different from the white culture. In fact, now here I interject myself and I sort of interpret Jung's statement. One way of looking at the alchemy of American culture is that on the one hand is the largely Puritan-influenced white culture, mainstream culture. On the other hand is the black and American Indian cultural matrix, very old, very different, and having cultural orientation significantly different, let's say, from the Puritan one. And then, so here they are, let's say, the king and the queen. I don't know which one you want to make masculine, which one you want to make feminine, or which one you want to make the sun, which one you want to make the moon. It doesn't really make any difference. But there is an alchemical opposite of these two. Then there is a third one, and that is like Mercury, the medium of the conjunction. And what is that? In my estimation, that is the old Hermetic America of the founders. That is sort of the orientation of people like Franklin and Washington and Jefferson and Madison and so forth, who knew, actually consciously knew, the alchemical principle and knew the Hermetic principle, and who wanted the country to be of that kind. And so here are the opposites acting upon each other, commingling with each other, while the Hermetic medium of the conjunction tries to facilitate a conjunction and a union which might lead to a real big transformative development in the future. Now, in our remaining time, I will try to pinpoint a few areas, specific areas, where these conjunctions may take place. And let me backtrack a little bit. You might say this is fantasy and romanticism. Because after all, what influence does the American Indian or Native American matrix have? I mean, you know, go to the reservations, for heaven's sakes. Well, maybe if there are more and more casinos, you know, the dear people will make more and more money, and we know that money is power in this country, and maybe then something will happen. But let's see, you know, there is no realistic influence there. However, Jung said that that doesn't make any difference, that there is a kind of mysterious psychic influence. This is certainly not rational, but then these things are not. That the soul of this land is still in part Indian, American, Native American, whatever you want to call it. It comes out in different ways. Certainly Jung wasn't talking about the Beverly Hills shamans and people like that, you know, who are driving to the Vision Quest in their Mercedes, and the sort of flap doodles that these are the caricature of the real situation. And much of the alleged interest in Native American matters, including Native American, quote, spirituality, because we don't dare to say religion, you know, that's become a bad word. These are caricatures of the real psychological situation. But at a very subtle level, you might say there are archetypes here which enter everybody, whatever their skin color, whatever their cultural backgrounds, and influence them. They influence the Irish who came here. Probably they even influence Hungarians like me. Or if I had any children, they would influence those. But to my great delight, I never had any. And they're certainly not about to start now. And on the other hand, there is that puritanical streak, and they are constantly interacting and clashing with each other. Let's say there is one area, you might say the native reality has to do with the, and this is not a subject that I often talk about because I have very mixed feelings about it on many levels, again, and I am not at all politically correct in this regard or any other regard. Listen, I traveled a long ways and made great sacrifices to get away from political correctness 40 years ago in Europe. You know, we called it communism. And I'll be damned, literally damned, if I'm going to now adopt a different kind of dogmatic political correctness in this country. That's not why I came here. And I have no desire to fall in line with any kind of dogma that is pushed around in society, whether it has to do with smoking, or whether it has to do with jogging, or whether it has to do with other subtler issues. I will maintain the kind of independence that I sought when I came here. All right, now after this little personal explosion of Mount Etna, we can go on to something. Let's say the reality, the view of reality of the ancient matrix toward the land, toward the earth, is that the earth is something sacred. It is the body of a being. And also that the earth does not belong to anyone, which means it belongs to all. A certain kind of undifferentiated communalism. No lines, no fences, no boundaries of property, tribal territories, but no personal property. As against this, you have the Calvinistic cultural reality, the family farm, the individual property, where the land serves the human and is owned by the human, where there is a rule over the land, wherein the exploitation of the land exalts the individual, that earthly life is an arena wherein we humans excel and thus prove our predestined status as the chosen of Calvin's God. Now, all of these have good and bad sides, and we have to realize that the ancient point of view comes from a much earlier cultural matrix. But then in some ways the cultural matrix from which the Calvinist point of view comes from is now also becoming ancient, you know, because that goes back to the Reformation era, to the 1600s and so on. That's not exactly contemporary either. And then, of course, there is the Hermetic solution, which says these positions can be reconciled, but they have to be reconciled consciously, that the real value is neither the earth nor what you get out of the earth, but consciousness. You. What is important is not what comes out of the earth, whether it's oil or whether it's crystals, but what comes out of you, what is present within you. How is it going to come out into manifestation? That's the important thing. That the others are really at best but metaphors for this. But, keep that in mind because that's really important, whether I get to all of these points or not. The alchemical principle is never that one of the two opposites is right and the other one is wrong. That one should win out. If salt wins out over sulfur, there is no alchemy. Yet we are always associating ourselves with one of the polarities. We are either Republican or we are Democrat, which incidentally is apparently dated. Now we don't have that anymore. We have conservatives and liberals, you know. And so we are always one or the other. We have excluded the middle. And yet it's somewhere in the middle that that alchemical transformation takes place. Because alchemical transformation takes a little from here, takes a little from there, takes a little from here, takes a little from there. Look at another issue. Where do we locate, say, the center of our psychic motivation? Again, the ancient point of view means an approach really largely with the heart. When C.G. Jung met a chief of the Pueblo Indians back before the war and so forth, and had a long conversation with him, the Indian chief said to the psychologist, he said, "You know, doctor, the white man is crazy." And Jung said, "Oh, I know." He says, "That's how I make my living." You know? And then the Indian said, "The white man is crazy because he thinks with his head. Anybody who thinks with his head is crazy." He says, "We think with our heart. That's what you have to think with. The heart is the tribe. The head is the individual within society. The heart is concrete, it's specific. The head is abstract." And so, again, you know, from time to time we have arising within the social milieu the tendency to look at ourselves as we, the people. This kind of populist emphasis. And this was always very strong in America. You know, nowhere on earth could you find so many associations, clubs, fraternal organizations, orders, and churches as in United States. I mean, I was astonished when I came here, and there are not only the Masons, which you expect to be around, although in Europe they were pretty secret, but every doggone thing, the Elks and the Moose and the Rotarians and the this and the that, and this is all outcome really of 18th and 19th century American history. You know, the Americans were very gregarious, and it's a kind of psychological tribalism. The Calvinist emphasis is more individual. There may be a community, but a community of individuals. Abstractions of the head matter more than intuitions of the heart. Faith is more important than spiritual experience. The individual has to be righteous. You see, as we said before. So there again, there is a big disparity, and it keeps sort of bouncing back and forth in the American psyche. Somewhere there must be a reconciliation. Let's say there must come about communities within which the individual can flourish spiritually. Communities that are like an alchemical vessel. But it hasn't happened yet, but it might. Another one is what I have called the sacralization of action. Again, the ancient model is that ceremonies must be kept intact. No substitutions, no analogies will do. But it's not New Age, you know. The New Age is much more like the lady whom I saw on, of course it was on like probably on the Comedy Channel, who was parodying a cooking show. And she went through this long recipe as to how to do a certain dish with a chicken. And at the end she said, and if you can't find the chicken, then take a fish. You know? Now, right? But, you know, in a traditional setting, in sacred action, you can't make substitutes. They have to be done exactly, accurately. The Calvinist reality works with substitutes and analogies. The head reality is always more important than the actual reality. Ideas matter, not symbols. You know, that's a very perilous position, but you see it everywhere. People are full of ideas. They turn these ideas into dogmas. They worship their ideas. We live right now, we live in a culture of incredible idol worship, and that idol worship is the idol worship of people's ideas. People have their own ideas, they have their own projections, they are often influenced by others, political correctness, this, that, and the other thing, but that is what they worship, not the actual situation. But you know, in certain ways that's very convenient, because you can be terribly concerned about the earth and saving the earth and all of that, and put up a big show on Earth Day, whenever that is, but at the same time you still drive a sports utility vehicle, you know. That's the way things work, because it's an idea that we are attached to, not the reality of the situation. So what we need is the consciously performed ritual and symbol, authentically performed, but with an individual consciousness, when the individual tries constantly to relate himself consciously to what is happening. Well, there are a number of these points, and I certainly can't go into all of them, but there may be about two more. Here is another conjunction of the opposites, or maybe it's not a conjunction yet, but the existence of opposite. I would call it the vision quest path versus standard education. The ancient way, which comes from a hunter mentality, says, so to say, go on the road. Learn from what is there. You know, learn from life. Observe the synchronicities. Mysteries of the path on your travel. Dynamic learning in action. Now, this existed in American society all along. How many of your Wild West heroes, the Wyatt Earps and the Doc Holidays and people like that, were people of very extensive schooling? You know, you were lucky if they knew how to write. And some of the great spiritual geniuses that came out of America. Joseph Smith, the Mormon prophet. You know, this guy started a world religion, a major one that is getting bigger and bigger by the day. It is one of the few religions, at least of Western provenance, that are still growing like crazy. Not just here, but everywhere. It grows about at the rate that Islam grows. Only Islam was bigger to begin with, you know, so it's a bigger religion. And Joseph Smith never went to school. His mother taught him how to read and write. He taught himself Hebrew. He read the scriptures in Hebrew. He had an instructor, an Austrian Jew in Kabbalah and things like that later on in life before he got killed. But, you know, what he became and what he started certainly wasn't the result of school marm education, you know. So this had always been there. But the white culture says, you know, you got to learn it in school. Big school, big university, big high school, and so forth, and now what we have found doesn't really work. Again, some kind of creative conjunction must come about. Maybe to some extent we need to modify the notion that just going to school is going to create a better person. But on the other hand, we also need to recognize what education is supposed to be about, which means to draw forth something. Educare, that's what it means. Ducare has the same root as a duke, which is supposed to be a leader, to lead out, to lead the potential out from within the person. Now, to what extent and degree is our education still doing that? So once again, I think the primordial archetypes, perhaps, of America, and the later ones need to be reconciled. And last, but certainly not least, there is, and there has been a lot of flapdoodle about that in recent years, and a few true things have come out, which is really the spirituality of ancient America, which is shamanism. Shamanism is the quest for ecstasy, for trance, for the non-ordinary state of consciousness. And the Puritan is the very opposite of that. Anything that's ecstatic, any excitement within the religious field is terribly, or any other field for that matter, is tremendously suspect. The reason that they killed the witches was because the witches saw things and went into states that were other than ordinary. But the ecstatic strain always popped up in various places in America, and certainly not just among the poor Native Americans or Indians. There were the Shakers, there were the Holy Rollers, there was the evangelical fervor, there were the Mormons, there was spiritualism beginning in the middle of the 19th century, tremendously shamanistic phenomenon. And in our own era, which I think probably pretty much everybody in this room remembers, the blessed and controversial psychedelic 60s. You know, it always pops up. The ecstatic, the shamanic strain, it's almost something that radiates out of the earth and catches the American psyche at various times. It's something that demands attention. But of course, the Puritan strain is there. Oh no, that's going to destroy everything. Yeah, it's going to be the end of the world. You know, Timothy Leary was the Antichrist. Something has got to be done. Well, I tell you what, if there is such a thing as an Antichrist, and it's never any worse than Timothy Leary, then we're okay. We're not going to have any Antichrist. Not that I particularly like the old Irishman. I think that his problem was that he not only kissed the Blarney Stone, but he swallowed it. You know, he just had too big a mouth and too big a sense for drama, and he spoiled a lot of things. So, war on drugs, war on this, war on that. The raves with the ecstasy are going to destroy the country. Give me a break. You know, it's nonsense. But it is the projection of the anti-ecstatic consciousness of the Puritan. Now, somewhere along the line, a reconciliation of these positions has to come about. Certainly, a work ethic-oriented industrial civilization can't be totally ecstatic. You know, if your bus driver takes LSD before he gets on the bus and things like that, you know, I have a feeling you won't be so happy getting on that bus or on that streetcar. I mean, there has to be some rhyme and reason and some order in these things. But once again, neither side can ultimately completely and totally win. There has to be a higher synthesis that alchemical mercury has to come in and say, yes, this is legitimate, and yes, this is legitimate, and we can somehow reconcile them in such a way so that transformation can take place. You know, the Greeks weren't exactly stupid people. I mean, not only did they have Plato and all kinds of great artists and all kinds of other great thinkers, but they were and they still are supremely practical merchants and people like that. You know, the Greek city-states were rich. This was not some kind of a besotted culture, some spacey shamans wandering around in the Amazon jungle. These were the most civilized people in the Mediterranean. And yet, they had their mysteries. They had the Eleusinian mysteries. You went there and you prepared yourself for 6 months to take the mystery. And then you underwent very big altered state consciousness, probably with, in addition to all the teaching and so forth, with some substance that was mixed into the cacaon, into the drink of the Eleusinian mysteries. Did that harm the Greek civilization? Heck no! A practical, personal lawyer like Cicero, the Roman, said the Eleusinian mysteries were the greatest ennobling influence of the world. You know? So it's not a matter that you have to descend into a state where all of society is going to be composed of a bunch of spacey hopheads. you know. But on the other hand, you don't have to wage a monumental war on everything that alters consciousness. Somewhere there must be an alchemical middle which can make these things come out correctly. What is then the conclusion? I don't mean to say that what I have now outlined here about American society is the God's truth. It's very oversimplified. There are other factors involved. But I think on the whole we see that American society at all various different levels still to this day consists of opposites interacting with each other. We have a two-party system. A third party, a fourth party never really managed to amount to a hill of beans in this country. On the other hand, look at Italy. Look at 30 parties. Look at Russia when it shook the Soviet yoke. Really rather endearing and rather funny. You even had a party that was the beer drinking party. You know, I mean, I'd like to preside over a party like that, as long as the beer is good. There's some of that kvass in Russian kvass is not very good. The Czechs make good beer, the Russians don't. And the point is not that one political party or one philosophy of the opposites ever wins out completely, but that they continue to interact with each other. That there is a loyal opposition, and that there is one in the government, and sometimes it just by a few votes, but still, that keeps going back and forth, keeps going back and forth. The king and the queen are interacting with each other, and out of their interaction, rather than from the victory of the policies of either of them, comes out some kind of a good result. Similarly, let's say labor and management. In the 19th century, when before there were labor unions, when management, the bosses had it all their way, it wasn't a good situation. Well, it was perhaps a good situation for the people on top. It wasn't a very good situation for the workers. Then came the labor unions, and then their, you know, exchange, interchange occurred. And by dealing with each other in an alchemical exchange, American industry, American business prospered tremendously. Now, a lot of the labor unions have become corrupt. A lot of them have become wrong-headed, all kinds of things. You know, things never remain right. But you can see the operation of the principle. Somehow that principle, which to this degree and extent doesn't really quite exist anywhere in the world, to some degree in England, which after all, there is a relationship and was somewhat the model, the parliamentary system. But let's say the alchemical system recognizes that, first of all, there has to be creative change. But violent revolutionary change is not creative, it's destructive. We have seen that. We have seen what emerged out of the Russian Revolution, something worse than has been there before. We saw what emerged out of the Iranian Revolution. We saw something that emerged out of the Chinese Revolution. That's no longer alchemy, but it's a miscarriage of alchemy. And that is where the democratic system, wherein the forces are allowed to interact with each other, can be very much instrumental for this kind of an alchemical matrix. But it requires an absence, if at all possible, of fanaticism. Fanaticism causes explosions. When the alchemical kitchen explodes and the alchemical vessel is damaged, the alchemical process won't take place. You know, you have to be careful. And in this regard, I have my worries, I have my concerns. I have a feeling that when I came to this country in the early 1950s, in 1952 to be precise, the discourse in the public arena was far more moderate, far more reasonable. That there has been an increase of fanaticism, that there has been an increase of passion in the political arena, an unwillingness to consider that your opponent might also have a point, an inflation with your own point of view, that you are right and you are completely right, and therefore everybody else is completely wrong. You know, that's a very dangerous position. That's kind of the position that the inquisitors adopted in the Middle Ages. We are right. You are a heretic, you are in error, and error has no right against the truth. Therefore, I have a right to do away with you. That is the ultimate conclusion to which fanatical positions devolve. Neither do I think that good alchemy is accomplished in the streets. I think that more dignified and more moderate alchemical vessels have to be created. Yeah, now and then there might be room for a demonstration or something like that. And so there are a lot of things to think about. There are a lot of things to keep in mind. I think that a kind of alchemy can work in society. It will never be perfect because human society is not perfect. The perfection is a potential. The perfection is not an actuality. But we have to keep working for that potential, and the potential is individual. If we keep remembering that society is a vessel for the individual. Societies have no life, no existence of their own. Jung said very correctly that a society, a state, a government is an epiphenomenon. It is a byproduct of individuals. Where would it be without the individuals? Did God invent governments? Did God create governments? Not even Genesis, which is a heavily flawed scripture, I think, says that on whichever day it was, God created the government. It doesn't say that. It created the heaven and the earth and the waters and then finally old Adam and all of that. But not the government. You know, governments have no a priori existence. They are an instrumentality of convenience for individuals. But one thing about an instrument of convenience is that it ought to be convenient. And a lot of governments are no longer convenient. So I hope that I was able to put forth a number of ideas which might act as stimuli in your own minds and in your own considerations for the application of alchemical principles of government. As I say, I don't say that the details of what I have said are all flawless and true. But I was trying to demonstrate how these principles might be working. Some of them indeed are working and others ought to be working. And if we keep considering them and are conscious about all of this, then perhaps our society might be working a bit better and thereby facilitate the alchemical transformation of the individual. So thanks very much and we'll see you next time.
Copyright MNI by BC Recordings, catalog number 300105. For more information about available lecture titles and for many other resources, visit gnosis.org. That's GNOSIS.ORG.